My guest once again today is Carl van Wolfoten, is a retired professor, a professor of comparative political and economic institutions at the University of Amsterdam. Before that, he lived and traveled through India, Turkey, Southeast Asia, and Japan, working as a newspaper correspondent before giving that up to write books. Carl van Wolfoten has a deep interest in the U.S. political scene and its failings, as well as that of its media, which he dissected in an essay, Karl Rove's Prophecy, which I found in UNS Reviews, January online edition. We began discussing it 2 weeks ago, and we'll be continuing today. Welcome back, Carl van Wolfoten, Takes on the World.
Thank you, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be on your program.
And it's my pleasure to have you, believe me. Well, today in Ukraine's capital, Kiev, and I suspect in certain think tanks in Washington, they are celebrating the third anniversary of Viktor Yanukovych's departure from the Ukraine capital and the successful overthrow of that country's legally elected president, orchestrated to a large degree by Washington. In my commentary before getting you on the phone, I traced the current wave of anti-Russian hysteria being generated by America's liberal intelligentsia to that coup. Is that close to how you see it?
Yes, of course it is. First of all, celebrating isn't quite proper. I mean, there's nothing to celebrate in the Ukraine, and it's in a pretty dismal state with very unhappy people. And, of course, the result of that coup d'etat, which is what it was, triggered by a number of factors, but very much encouraged and pushed along by Victoria Nuland, who was the top official in the United States, overseeing Eastern Europe. That coup d'etat has brought very little, if anything, disaster upon the country. Very tragic, because, of course, this is not what the Ukrainian people wanted.
Well, I know just before the escalation of the protest in Maidan, Yanukovych had made an arrangement with European presidents, several of them, to have an election that would have a peaceful transition of power. And that's when the coup, the powers and people in the street began to escalate. And later it turns out that the U.S. reporting that the police started firing on demonstrators was incorrect. And BBC did an investigation that showed that it was the snipers from among the protesters.
It has never been, I mean, if it has been investigated, we haven't heard the results. But there were snipers, and they were firing indiscriminately. They were killing police as well as protesters. So it's extremely unlikely that it was part of the then official government. No, it created the kind of situation that made the coup easier. Indeed, it's the Europeans who had just brokered a deal for a peaceful transfer of power at the end of that year, the end of 2014. And, of course, then the Europeans did nothing. They didn't protest the people who came in through the coup. They didn't do anything. They just accepted the reality created by Victoria Nuland and the American ambassador, Bright, in Kiev. A very sad story, and of course it's something that helped trigger this huge avalanche of anti-Russian rhetoric, anti-Russian propaganda that has since engulfed not only the United States, but also Europe. I can tell you that the country where I live, the Netherlands, is truly marinated in this propaganda, and I think when you look at it, it's sort of you get the feeling it is impossible to ever get that straight. The demonization of Putin, who is believed to be a culprit of all manner of evil deeds, has gone beyond anything that I could ever imagine. I was a correspondent in East Asia for almost two decades, and I mostly watched political developments in various parts of the world, And I would not have believed if you had told me then what would ensue here as a result of the demonization of Putin. It's quite unbelievable.
The strange thing is that most of the demonization, instead of being taken, being carried by the traditional right-wing Republican hawks, other than John McCain and Lindsey Graham, whose little talk to the Ukrainian troops I played a few moments ago, back in December, it is being led by liberals, not neoliberal, liberals, and people who have historically been anti-war, except they didn't manage to come up with a single anti-war demonstration after the invasion of Iraq, and didn't call for any special commissions to investigate who was responsible for the Iraq War and the phony intelligence. That never happened. And yet here we have unproven, and I don't believe provable, accusations, allegations, which they don't even call allegations anymore. They speak as facts. Russia interfered with the election. Yeah. And you have liberal columnists, the New York Times, Mother Jones, the whole bunch of them ganging up. It's like everything is topsy-turvy.
It's very much an upside-down world where, liberals, as you said, not just neoconservatives or staunch neoliberals, but liberals in general in the United States, who used to have a fairly good understanding of what the right wing was up to and what the CIA and other so-called intelligence agencies were up to, and the warmongers and so on, the military-industrial complex. And at this moment, those liberals have sided with these very same former enemies. It's quite unbelievable. And make no mistake, I mean, established and once much admired news media like the New York Times are fully with all this and are participating and, in fact, are indispensable to having created this situation.
And we have National Public Radio, which is which appeals to the intelligentsia that doesn't listen to AM radio, going full stop. Every morning you have more of an attack, interviewing some government official, talking about the danger and threats of Russia and Putin. And never will one hear anyone being interviewed who has any critical analysis of this, and it's the same as it was before the Iraq War and during the U.S. interventions in Central America, supporting the Contras in Central America. So there is no media other than some alternative media, internet media, that is trying to counter this. Is there anything, is there any counter to this barrage in Europe?
Not the mainstream media. No, there is no counter to them. Nothing on also TV news programs. There is nothing really dissenting from this huge wave of propaganda. It is something that exists, that comes from the editorial departments of the media. And it's a matter of the elites. It's the politicians and the people who are respected intellectuals that hold forth. They cling to these lies and this nonsense. But you do notice, and I imagine you probably also do in the United States, you do notice that among ordinary people that you run into, there is a general sense that something is fishy about this all. When you have such a daily this daily vilification of Russia, of Putin, etc., people begin to wonder, is something else happening here? It's very weird. Because they have never experienced anything like this before. you know, during the Cold War, when there was a threat, believed to be a threat from the Soviet Union, no Russian party secretary or any top official was ever treated in this way as Putin is. And, you know, other enemies that, of course, Europeans have experience with enemies, and they also have not, fortunately, experienced real war on their own continent for a long time. But they're not, no, they cannot understand what's going on here. So they doubt, I think. I run into these people who ask me what I think, and they're fairly quick to agree that this is not something that is based on facts. It's something that is based on fantasies, and a fantasy of entities that have long ago lost any kind of effective political control, which of course is what happened to the intelligence agencies in the United States and to the military-industrial complex, to the Pentagon, and so on. It's something that, you know, it's something about institutions that people do not understand, because they are trying to explain the world on the basis of theories that have little to do with reality. So it's a pretty big mess, and unfortunately in Europe, Europe goes along. Europe has just inherited the enemies that come with that come from what the United States believes are its enemies.
Well, this brings me back to the subject of your article. Karl Rove prophesied that they would create realities which the press would follow, but really not challenge. And this seems a perfect example of a reality that is so full of holes it would require somebody, Lewis Carroll, to put a sequel to Alice in Wonderland or Through the Looking Glass, because how else can one describe the mass, insanity of people who otherwise were soon to be critical thinkers, buying and praising the U.S. intelligence services as a source of truth.
Yes, and I could say something here about the Europeans today and the Europeans at the time of the invasion of Iraq. In those days, as you may remember, there were huge demonstrations. A million people in Britain and other places took to the streets. The media never fully covered this, but they were the biggest demonstrations that we have seen in recent times. Okay, in those days, there was a lot of doubt about whether the George W. Bush people knew what they were doing. There was a lot of doubt as to what the neocons were up to. But what emerged at that time, especially here in the Netherlands, was this idea that we have no choice. And this was frequently voiced in headlines or in commentary on TV, like, without America, it won't work. Things will not work without the United States. At that time, I began to understand that what had happened, you know, this is a faith. Without the United States, it won't work. And the Europeans, although very skeptical at that time, had adopted, certainly the elite, the politicians at the top of the governments of the member states of the European Union, they had adopted this faith that without the United States, they would not have a future. The United States is necessary to protect those nations that exist in the Atlantic basin. And I call this Atlanticism. It's a faith. It's an ideology, of course. It's a faith. It's something that you believe in without questioning. This has become much worse than it was at the time of the invasion of Baghdad. That faith has taken root among intelligent people, among people who should know much better, among the journalists who should understand what is happening. And some of them might understand. I mean, I run into them, but they have hardly any choice but to go along with the current. Because if they do not, they, as we discussed last time, I was on your program, they endanger their careers. They, you know, they may lose their jobs. But this has really become very, very bad. And you could only hope that things will become so ridiculous in the United States as they at this moment appear to be on the way to becoming, so utterly ridiculous that there is bound to be an awakening. At least I hope so.
Well, that brings us back to one of the things that you mentioned in the article is the unwillingness or the fear among journalists or public figures with reputations to question major acts, historical acts that have influenced our times out of all proportion. First, the assassination of President Kennedy, which even later on a congressional committee admitted it was not one person acting alone. But nobody can talk about that or talk about it. Even a number of books have been written, but they never get any popular discussion in the mainstream media or even the alternative media. And, of course, 9/11, which had a lot of questions about it, but nobody is really going to take – no public figures are going to – take a position questioning or calling for a special commission, another one, not the one that covered it up, to talk about that without losing their job, risking their reputation, or having to become what they call a 9/11 buff to defend themselves.
Yes.
And one of the people who've been very influential, who you write about, as a gatekeeper on both of these events, happened to be the most famous political icon on the left, Noam Chomsky, who both and you wrote about him something that I'm going to read, which I found very actually refreshing, because I've written a couple of articles about Professor Chomsky, who I happen to know. And used to respect, and you wrote, or I'll begin, what I find more difficult to stomach is the position of someone who is worshipped by what used to be the left and who has been guiding that class of politically interested Americans as to where they cannot go. Chomsky, you say, does not merely keep quiet about it, but mocks students who raise logical questions prompted by their curiosity, thereby discouraging a whole generation studying at universities and active in civil rights causes. Why don't you elaborate on that?
Well, I think it's important to, put your sights on Chomsky, because it's not just an unimportant, immaterial old man who guides the left, especially the extreme left in the United States. He tells conscientious Americans who want to know better, who do not a priori necessarily believe the authorities, he tells them where they can and cannot go. Now, he, of course, has done work in the past, mapping out America's misdemeanors and crimes as part of an imperialist scheme, an imperialist program. And he has done some good work there. Today, when you look at this today, there is very little new that he tells us. And in fact, I do not find much depth in the, in trying to find out the why and how this is done. It's just repetition of, but that's at this moment neither here nor there. What is important is that there are areas where people should not go, and he delimits those areas. He says, it's like walking in the park. You can't go there. You can't walk on the grass there. That's not permitted, etc. He does that with the Warren report on Kennedy murder. He's done that, of course. Very vocally on the 9/11 case. Is that important? Of course it is, very. I mean, we have a war on terrorism which is justified by this 9/11. and this unending war. It's like the, or you know, in Orwell's 1984, there is this never-ending war between those the continents that the world was divided into, and because you have this war, the authorities had the power to, you know, to do with the people whatever they wanted. This is what war does. It has enabled a undermining and destruction of American civil liberties. It has given the CIA and other intelligence agencies, and of course this whole new homeland security complex, it has given them a power that really is the beginnings of the power of the police state. So it's important what Chomsky says. I had an interesting talk a few days ago with someone who he's a Hungarian. He's or at least Hungarian parents, and he is a linguist who has studied with Chomsky at MIT. And he's become very interested in developments in the East European countries. So he wanted to see me because he wanted to know more about, you know, my take on what has been happening in this respect, the kind of things that we are talking about. And he told me a very interesting thing. He says, you know, when he was at MIT, because he spoke Hungarian and other languages from, you know, the East European countries, when there was a mission from these countries to the United States, the officials would take the members, or these East Europeans who would come and visit and see what how things were in the United States, would take them to Chomsky to demonstrate that also in the United States there are dissenters. Also we, you know, we have a luxury of having people who disagree with us. And he termed Chomsky as a, you know, a shop with window dissenter. It's the kind of the dissenter that you cultivate and you keep in reserve in order to apply him whenever necessary.
I have to laugh because this is exactly my feeling. This he is presented. His books have a quote on the back, the world's leading intellectual, quote, New York Times.
Yes.
Well, as someone who's criticized the New York Times, I question whether Professor Chomsky's judgment in having that on the back of the book. He's written so many books, most of them repeats, I should say, of other books that he's written, so it makes it pretty easy to write another one. But he's like an icon, and you don't question this icon. People look at you, your eyes begin to go glassy, and you don't want to go there. It's the same thing with 9/11.
Maybe we shouldn't spend all that much time on him because there are very important things happening. But I had a big problem with him when I was reporting from the Cambodian border. I was in Thailand, and there were refugees from Cambodia who had escaped at great, you know, great risk to their own lives from the Khmer Rouge, the people that had taken over in Cambodia. What was happening there was something quite extraordinary that has not been widely understood. But what had happened there was the Khmer Rouge had attempted and succeeded in taking out all the agents of cohesion in a society. It started with money, no more money. It started with emptying people from the cities, no more urban structures that could in any way obstruct an authoritarian regime, but also no more marriages. Married couples were split up and sent to the countryside separately. No more friendships. Friendships in the camps that then came into existence was forbidden. All those agents of cohesion were taken out of that society. We really have no other example in world history where this has succeeded. It's very interesting and very terrible, of course. So there was Chomsky telling people, no, this isn't true. It's all propaganda. It's all propaganda on the CIA because they want to, whatever they wanted to do in Cambodia, whatever the Americans had planned for Cambodia. And this was a problem because I had to convince my audience, and I know colleagues of mine working side by side in refugee camps and on the border where these people were coming across, we were trying to convince the world about what was happening. And Chomsky was a big problem because he kept saying, this isn't happening, and he was undermining our credibility. So I had certainly since then have been extremely suspicious of this man because it is very clear that he was not doing, at that time, he was not doing his homework. And I think he is not doing his homework on quite a few things. So, okay, there are people who may believe what they want to believe, but when they have a certain stature, and of course he is worshipped, I mean, you can just imagine much of the left, and I've run into this in Japan and everywhere, really, that the moment you mention his name, all discussion stops because he is the great saint of leftist beliefs. So this kind of influence, of course, is disastrous. And therefore, because the left in the United States is not capable of bringing up this issue without feeling terribly guilty, because this is how it works, without feeling guilty and without inviting the accusation that they believe in a perfectly natural thing, by the way, they believe in conspiracies. Because of that, we won't go any further in understanding what actually happened in 2001 and what is the essential cause of this great change that has come over the world as a result of entities in the United States that had lost, that were lost to political control, now dictating what's going to happen next. This is why what is happening in the United States at the moment with Trump, who believes, is said to believe that these intelligence agencies have to be cut down to size, who believes that this is something to tackle in this war between the new president and the intelligence agencies, you would hope that also those people who believe that Trump is not a good president, that Trump has schemes for domestic policies that are not good for the United States, also those people should see what unbelievable dangerous situation they are in.
My guest is Carl Van Wolferen, a very enlightening conversation that you're most likely to hear anywhere else on American radio. I do appreciate your comments. You know, going back to Cambodia, I remember Professor Chomsky and his defense of the Khmer Rouge, which I actually bought into at that time. He has never apologized for his errors on that. He's never actually apologized for an error on anything. I myself have written a couple of critical articles about him, well-documented, about his domestic damage control for the Israel lobby in this country, which is another story, but it's the same operation, same day. The election of Trump and the division over Russia has caused a tremendous division in what I would have called the left in this country if we actually had one.
Yes.
And it's caused breaking up of friendships and so on with people. Mr. Trump's position, for example, on deportations, although he's actually just continuing escalating what Barack Obama began,
without
these people calling for protest against Obama's deportation policy.
Right.
Matter of fact, he was the deporter in chief.
Yes.
And so even the countries that Trump put on the ban list, so to speak, the Muslim countries, those countries had already been picked out by Barack Obama. So it's like Trump stepped into, with his larger shoes, into what Obama had already begun without much of a whimper from those people who are more concerned with domestic issues than actually serious issues affecting other people's lives, not Americans.
Yes. You know, it would help the Europeans if a prominent American who agrees with what you're saying and who agrees generally with what we are trying to make sense of the situation. And of course, to some extent, we are really trying to discover something that is still in the dark. But there's general agreement, and I think there are quite a few Americans also who agree with us and who also understand how dangerous this is. If they would speak up loudly, so it could be heard on this side of the Atlantic, it will make a huge difference here, because then people here would quote them, could quote them. And at the moment, intellectually, on at least on political affairs, Europe is as close to death as you can imagine. It's moribund. It's not active intellectually in the political field. It's pretty awful. To explain this, how that happened, we would need an hour or longer. But just take it from me. And I think that if Americans could come out and say to Europeans, you should do away with NATO because it's dangerous. It's one of the most dangerous organizations in the world. It helps the warmongering. It helps the aggressive attitudes of Washington towards Russia and China, but especially Russia. NATO is dangerous. Americans should raise their voice and say this. The only person who I remember who did this years ago was Paul Craig Roberts, and I sent him a thank you note for saying this, and I copied it on some of the stuff that I was writing on the internet. So very few people have done this. There was an American in Paris, William Pfaff, a very good journalist,
yes,
who once had a column in the International Herald Tribune, an extremely perceptive column on political affairs, and he kept saying this. And I had contact with him until his death a few years ago. And he kept on saying, how is it possible that Europeans do not see this? I can tell you how it's possible. So reducing an hour's worth of conversation on Europe is that those people who have risen to high-level positions in Europe have done so by not sticking out their necks, who have done so by buying into all this neoliberal and neoconservative ideology that is on offer from the other side of the ocean. And so unless they did so, they could not have risen to these positions. That means that Europe is now bereft of original political force. Of course, it exists among small groups. It exists here and there. Some people write books, and some people, sure. And they can see everything that I'm telling you now. But it is not a vibrant area of discussion on a level where citizens in the the member states of the European Union can participate. Americans could do something by just writing to Europeans publicly, of course, in their internet, in what they put on the internet and the books they write, etc., that NATO is a dangerous organization that makes sure that Europeans will not have a foreign policy of their own. Because if you have a defense policy that is tied to the defense policy of Washington and in fact dictated by it, how can you have a separate, independent foreign policy? Not possible. And if you don't have a foreign policy, then you don't get foreign policy intellectuals that can discuss with each other what would be a desirable course of action.
Well, it's interesting. I recall before the Ukraine crisis, there were articles in the paper questioning the future of NATO and if it had a future. And one of my theories is that the Ukraine crisis, one of the goals of it, because it had more than one, doesn't have to more than just one goal, was to justify the revival, the resuscitation of NATO that had lost its reason for existence. And we have the demands that all these countries who prefer to spend money taking care of their citizens set that aside and spend money buying weapons, presumably from the United States.
That's right. I mean, that's exactly what happened. NATO was, it was moribund. It was the Warsaw Pact, which NATO was a response. The Warsaw Pact had been abolished, and NATO should have been abolished, obviously. So that this hasn't happened is, I think, a historical tragedy, and it may still get us all into much worse trouble, because if you then, you talk with your friends and the people who may perhaps disagree with you in the Bay Area and who are thinking longingly of, suppose that Hillary would have won the presidency instead of Trump, that we would have been closer to war than we are now if that had happened. I'm sure of that. Because, Hillary, up to the very last moment, she was calling for a no-fly zone in Syria, which would have meant a direct military confrontation with Moscow. And that is a very risky thing to have, as I don't need to tell you. So what do we want more now? I think what we should all want most is no war. It's going to destroy us.
That is the issue of war. And I, without their would-be warrior queen, the people for war are pushing forward. One could imagine if she had been elected president, with Russia would be unified on Capitol Hill.
Yes.
There'd be no dissent whatsoever. And despite President Trump's domestic issues, which need to be met on the basis of those issues, not on the basis of another Cold War with Russia, we have much on our agenda, and I hope there are people who are able to deal with it. Carol Van Wolfferen, it was my pleasure to speak with you again. I look forward to doing it the next time, because it's been very refreshing, I'm sure, for our listeners to get your viewpoint from across the water. So thanks again for being our guest on Takes on the World.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.